Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Asma Khalid. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, a summit on gun violence takes place against the backdrop of a shooting last night in Dorchester that killed two people. And the CEO of Minuteman Health, Tom Policelli, on why the insurer has gone under state control and the problems he sees with the Affordable Care Act.
To me, the big issue is we've just artificially driven prices up too high.
Also, Google fires an employee over a memo he wrote. Could that be a sign of credibility problems for tech titans?
Google is one of the world's most powerful information sources. This is a company that we now know to be run by people who think that there are certain thoughts you shouldn't have and certain words you shouldn't say.
Plus, we'll get an update on the latest in the Top Chef trial. That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Asma Khalid. Last night in Dorchester, two men were found fatally shot in a burning car near the intersection of Eastman and Elder Streets. According to the Boston Police Department, the men were found dead at the scene. It was later determined that they had been shot before crashing their vehicle. Today, against that backdrop, the backdrop of that shooting, Mayor Marty Walsh and Police Commissioner William Evans held the fourth annual summit to address regional gun violence. Here's Commissioner Evans speaking about the shooting in Dorchester at the gun summit.
On our officer's arrival, they found a car that was fully engulfed by flames. The officers tried valiantly to try to get the two occupants out of that vehicle. And unfortunately, both were deceased. On further investigation, the two individuals were declared, and they were found to be suffering from gunshot wounds.
WBUR senior reporter Anthony Brooks was at that summit, and he joins us now. Anthony, hey, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Good to be here.
So, Anthony, what do we know about this murder? Do we have information at this point about what the shooting may have been about, what the cause was?
Well, Asma, as you heard from Commissioner Evans, here's what we know. In effect, there's more we don't know than what we do know, but here's what we know. Two men, a 24-year-old and a 42-year-old, were killed. As you heard, Evans confirmed that they had been shot. Police are still investigating this crime, which Evans suggested was likely gang-related, but there's still a lot that police don't know. They're actively encouraging the community to help out and let them know if they saw anything. At this point, police say they're looking for a silver van that was seen speeding away from the crime scene. Evans also said he's worried about possible retaliation. So police are braced for and worried about the possibility of more violence.
So, Anthony, this shooting brings the number of homicides in Boston just this year up to 31. That's up from the 23 in August of 2016. Shootings are also up about 25% this year overall than last year, according to data from the Boston Police Department. So it does seem that there's been an uptick in violence, at least recently. Did either Mayor Walsh or the commissioner, police commissioner, address that uptick?
Yeah, they both did, and they're clearly frustrated by it. Commissioner Evans said that increase amounts to about one shooting more a week compared to last year. But he also stressed that Boston remains a relatively peaceful city compared to many other cities that see literally hundreds of killings a year. Mm-hmm. Boston's numbers are still relatively low. But it has to be said that small consolation for people who live in the parts of Boston where this violence occurs. You know, Asma, just after this summit, I went into a place to grab a sandwich right in Dudley Square, and I spoke to a young mother who lives on Blue Hill Avenue in Dorchester, and she told me there's evidence of the violence every day, so much so that she doesn't allow her 11-year-old daughter to leave the house during the summer, and she's thinking of moving away from Boston. Now, I asked Commissioner Evans for his explanation for this uptick in gun violence, and here's what he said.
Well, there's too many guns out there, you know, and there's too many high-powered guns. So when these young kids who are 14 are holding guns that might have 16, 18 rounds in them, they're just randomly firing at people. And as a result, in these incidents, we have more people shot. But the issue is, how do these kids get the gun, and what can we do to take it off them?
So, Anthony, can you tell us, I mean, the commissioner sounds like he's just extremely sort of frustrated with what to do about this. Did Mayor Walsh talk about this as well?
Well, Mayor Walsh did, and of course, this came up as part of this gun violence summit. This is an effort by six states, 86 cities and towns, police chiefs and mayors were there. Uh-huh. And, you know, this is an annual effort to exchange ideas and best practices from all these guys from these states and these areas. So here's Mayor Walsh talking about the central goal of the summit. To work with people from other cities and towns to try to solve the issue of gun violence. Here's a bit of what he said.
We have an issue with illegal guns here in the city of Austin, city of Springfield, city of Lawrence, and many other cities and towns. Working across borders with our colleagues is how we're going to continue to work to solve these issues. It's also essential work in light of the obstruction in Washington that seems to block all the progress.
So, Asma, key point there, frustration about a lack of action cooperation from Washington. But mm-hmm. Walsh and the other mayors talked about efforts that they believe can make a difference.
So, Anthony, I know that Mayor Walsh has said that without national gun reform, the police here are essentially just fighting gun violence with one hand tied behind their backs, right? What
right.
can Massachusetts do to address gun violence if there isn't necessarily going to be reform, at least in the immediate sense, on the national level?
Well, they're sort of going full steam ahead on a number of programs, things like gun buyback programs. They talked today about new initiatives to encourage gun owners to access online information about how to keep their guns safe and out of the hands of people who shouldn't have them. Other initiatives are aimed at keeping guns out of the hands of people with mental illness. And here's Dan Rivera, the mayor of Lawrence. He was mm-hmm. at the gun summit today, and he said the summit itself represents a big step in the right direction, but as he said, much more needs to be done.
I'm hopeful because we keep meeting and talking about it and trying to stem the tide, but it feels like one step forward, three steps back, because on this issue, like the opioid crisis, like immigration, like a lot of federal government problems, they're absent. And they're not partnering with us.
So, Asma, again, you hear, as you can hear, a theme for a lot of people at this summit was the absence of sort of partnership with Washington.
Imagine, yeah. And Lawrence is a city that, you know, as we all know, has sort of been hit, I think, by some violence over the years. So it's really interesting there to hear Dan Rivera. So, Anthony, Mayor Walsh, I believe, also spoke about a piece of open carry legislation that would essentially, it seems like, allow people to be able to carry in all 50 states. He seems to be opposed to that legislation. And can you tell us a little bit more about his objection?
Right. Absolutely opposed to that legislation, because essentially that would allow folks to buy and carry a gun openly and do it in Massachusetts if federal law permits it. And this raises a big question. And one of these big concerns is here in Massachusetts, we have very tight, some of the most restrictive gun control laws in the country. But we're surrounded by states with much more liberal laws, states like Maine, New Hampshire, and Vermont, which make it much easier to buy guns and bring them into Massachusetts.
Bring them across state borders,
Absolutely. And Commissioner Evans made the point as well that Massachusetts is along the I-95 corridor, which is a kind of pipeline for guns from the south, so that, without a real national effort, or if the national effort is going in the other direction, there's only so much that can be done locally. And that was certainly one of the messages from this summit. We can raise the alarm, we can take some steps that make a difference, but without buy-in from the national level, we are limited as to what we can do. And we're reminded of that with that terrible crime that we were talking about at the top of the program.
In Dorchester. All right. Well, thank you so much, Anthony.
My pleasure, Asma.
That's WBUR senior reporter Anthony Brooks. And stay with us. Coming up, the CEO of Minuteman Health on why the insurance company is being taken over by the state. I'm Asma Khalid. This is Radio Boston. Earlier this month, state officials assumed control of Minuteman Health. It's a Boston-based health insurer created under the Affordable Care Act. The state says the company does not have sufficient capital to move forward into 2018. Minuteman began selling plans in 2013 on the state's health connector with a multi-million dollar loan from the federal government. The goal was to create a more affordable insurance option for patients. The company currently insures about 8,500 people in Massachusetts. Though it's now in receivership, the company says no member policies will be canceled and claims will continue to be paid. But this is all happening at an interesting moment for insurance companies. Divided politics in Washington are creating a period of instability and uncertainty for the ACA. So joining us now is Tom Policelli. He's the CEO of Minuteman Health. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
So to start with, Minuteman Health is now going into receivership. Can you explain to us what that means, what happens to the company now?
Sure. What this means is this is a wind-down process that is run by the Division of Insurance, the commissioner, and the people who act on his behalf. So this means that, you know, all the claims get paid, all the people are covered. Hospitals, physicians, everyone gets the monies that they are due all the way through the end of the policy year.
So, Tom, what happens to people who are currently insured through you all?
Nothing, really. Through the end of their policy year, they just keep doing what they're doing, get care as they need it, call us if they need any help getting that care, follow the policy as normal, as they normally would, and submit claims, and claims get paid.
Will Minuteman Health be offering plans in 2018?
So Minuteman Health, Inc., it will not be. That is
the
company
that
is that is winding down. What we have been working to do, we at the company have been working to do, is organize a new company, creatively titled Minuteman Insurance Company.
All right.
And our objective is to pick up for 2018 where Minuteman Health Inc. left off.
So just so I'm clear, if you are currently insured through Minuteman Health, you'll be covered throughout the 2017.
Yes.
No problem. But when you go for open enrollment, essentially, you will have to select a new insurance company, one of which could be potentially your new company.
That's right. So open enrollment should work the way it does every year, really. Go in and shop.
I guess I just want to clarify, because this is all happening sort of – I know there's a lot of moving parts at this point in time, right? Is the new company already has it already been approved at this point, or is this what you're in the process of doing, is essentially ensuring this transition can happen?
That's right. We're in the middle of the process. So the process is not an overnight one. It's a very long process with a long checklist and a long timeline. And so we've been going through, and thus far we've been able to successfully check all the boxes and meet all the deadlines and all that. There's still a bunch more to go, and we're not done yet.
So I guess you guys are in kind of a unique position there, right? Like at this point in time, you're a nonprofit insurance company, and you're positioning to become a for-profit insurance company.
Correct.
Can you explain what that means to me?
It means that money doesn't grow on trees, and so we need capital, and that's how we get it.
Can you sell stock being a for-profit
that's right.
company?
Okay. That's right. And that's what it comes down to. So an insurance company is basically – it starts off as a pile of cash. That's its job, because the idea of insurance is to take risks that we as individuals can't bear, be it homeowners insurance, what if my house burns down? And so someone has to have enough capital behind the policies in order to support it. And so that's why, again, the old company has the cash to pay that out. But the new company needs a new pile of cash to take on members and move forward.
So can you take us back in time a bit and walk us through what led to this outcome of where we are now with Minuteman Health being under state control?
Well, what I can say, if I could focus on how going forward will be different. I think I'm allowed to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So if we step back and look, I'm going to step far back.
Okay.
So Massachusetts did its own form of healthcare reform. It was successfully working for a bunch of years. And I should underscore bipartisan reform, healthcare reform. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't perfect, but it largely did its job. We covered 97.5% of the people about. Premiums were pretty stable. We had a lot of competitors, and the market seemed to be working pretty well. What's happened, the ACA has disrupted some of that, what had been going on in Massachusetts. Obviously, we had the connector went through its issues, which have all been sorted out, and the connector works very well now. But also on the financial side, things like this this risk adjustment program.
So let me just jump in here. Can you explain what the risk adjustment program is?
Sure. you know, look, the ACA is a complicated law. It was passed, you know, late one night. And mm-hmm. so there's things in it. No law is perfect. And one of the unfortunate rules that came off the law itself was this thing called risk adjustment. And the idea is a good idea, and it's one I've done before in my career. I've built some of these things. The idea is to say, well, if one insurance company has a bunch of healthy people mm-hmm. and another insurance company has a bunch of sick people, we should move money from the first insurance company with healthy people to the other one with the sick people.
Okay.
It's a logical idea, and it works. And insurance companies voluntarily enter into these types of arrangements on a regular basis. The problem is that the federal imposition of risk adjustment hasn't worked that way. It's actually introduced a lot of volatility. And if you step back and look, what you see is that companies that were smaller but lower cost and high growth tended to get hit. So Humana, Kaiser, Aetna, in markets where they were small but they grew because they had an affordable product, they got hammered. So Humana paid $950 million. That's a lot of money, even for Humana and some of these other carriers. And this is why they've been exiting exchanges. You can't deal with volatility like that when you're an insurance company.
Would you say that the risk adjustment factor is sort of the factor that's led to the current situation with you all?
I can't comment on the Minuteman Health, Inc. and where we are today. I can tell you that we have been very vocal on this topic.
And I know you all sued the federal government over this risk adjustment.
Yes, we have.
Yeah. Care to elaborate on that?
Sure. It's proceeding at a very rapid federal pace, which means that we haven't even seen the judge yet. So that's in September is the first appearance before the judge. Like I said, I mean, the feds have both admitted that there are issues and laid out a timeline. It's just too long to fix it. And they've also opened up the opportunity for states to jump in and take more action. And thus far, a few have. New York jumped in and just said, we're cutting everything by 30% under risk adjustment to try to dampen the volatility.
Massachusetts has not done anything of this
sort. Not in its current version has not, no.
So, Tom, I'd love to hear from you about what you think it means that a company like yours that was praised at its inception in 2012 when it received this $88.5 million loan from the federal government – that it was being praised at that point as a sort of model insurance company under the Affordable Care Act. And now that company can't compete under the regulations of the Affordable Care Act.
Yes. Thank you for that painful question. but it's quite true. I mean, the model we have is geared towards efficiency. And our target market are the folks who have a hard time finding affordable health insurance. That's why we're here. That's our whole purpose. And it is more than ironic or it's deeply painful.
I mean, you all were very much praised. I mean, I have here that then-Senator John Kerry said at the time that, quote, Minuteman Health's proposal is an exemplary model for the types of provider solutions that are called for by the Affordable Care Act. I mean, you all were called the exemplary model.
And I, of course, am modestly biased or immodestly biased on this topic. He's correct. And the model does work. We have shown that we can deliver more affordable products and help drive down the cost of health insurance so that more people can be covered. And let me give you a statistic on that. So New Hampshire, where most of our members are, is an outlier, has been until now an outlier nationally. So nationally, 85% of the people on the exchanges, the government exchanges, receive a subsidy. In New Hampshire, it's been 58%. And what that means is that people in New Hampshire have been able to afford insurance if they don't get a subsidy. So the middle income. And what that says about the rest of the country is most of the rest of the country, if you don't get a subsidy, you can't afford it.
You can't buy
you
health
can't
insurance
buy
on the exchange.
Right. So if you step back, the ACA, the goals the ACA had for coverage, half the people the ACA intended to cover are actually covered today. Half.
Got it.
The reason why the half aren't there is because they don't get a subsidy and this stuff just costs too much. So New Hampshire, what we've had is managed until now to keep the costs down, keep the premiums down, so more people could afford to buy. And that led to a healthier market and it creates a virtuous cycle. The more people in the market, then the more you're spreading the risk and you can keep prices down. And that's been a very good thing until now. 2018, all the insurance companies are looking at 40-plus% increases in New Hampshire. And I'm very worried. And a lot of people are very worried.
I mean, but Tom, what does that mean, though, that you all were called this exemplary model, right? And it sounds like you still believe in the model.
Deeply.
But at the same time, it has become very difficult for you to compete under the current regulations of the ACA.
So that's exactly right. So the model works. The regulations don't. The regulations are killing anything that is affordable.
You know, some Republicans saw Minuteman's failure, I should say, as a proof that Obamacare has been a disaster. What do you think?
I really don't have a lot of patience for a lot of the political discussion on health care. You know, we've always tried, and I remain kind of politically purple, kind of right in the middle. I don't think that any law I think the only law that's ever worked in Washington is the law of unintended consequences. These are big, complicated topics. Nothing's perfect. Again, look what the Commonwealth did with our bipartisan health care reform. It was a negotiated solution. And very importantly, it was constantly tweaked. So when we found little problems, we'd adjust. We'd measure, adjust. That's what grown-ups do.
And so far, the ACA has not been adjusted.
The ACA, right? It hasn't been. A lot of the Democrats were afraid tweaking meant they were admitting there was a problem, and all the Republicans didn't want to tweak. They wanted to burn it. Mm-hmm. And so we've got something that has just been too rigid, and that's not the way life works. Mm-hmm. Like I said, I don't have a lot of patience for a lot of the discussion.
But you don't subscribe to the whole repeal and replace and start all over again.
I think both sides of what I I can't watch a lot of cable TV these days, but both sides of what I see, I don't really don't ring true for me very much. Yeah. And to me, and this is through the chair where I sit, the big issue is we've just artificially driven prices up too high. And so if you really step back, when you see in New Hampshire 40%+ increases, hospitals aren't making twice as much money. The nurses aren't making twice as much money. Mm-hmm. Drugs didn't quintuple in cost.
And so the costs are going
What's really going on are these are policy errors that are driving prices up.
You know, before we got into the studio, Tom, I was talking to one of our producers who said that she was unemployed for a bit and she bought Minuteman insurance. And she said she bought it in part because it was significantly cheaper than Blue Cross, right? I mean, it was the more affordable option that provided good services for her. Where do those patients go now? I mean, look, this is one testimonial. It is what it is. Mm-hmm. But I thought it was interesting that she of her own accord brought up that, you know, during that period in time, Minuteman was the more affordable option for her. Where do those patients go now?
Well, if we do what we intend to do, they're going to be able to go to a new Minuteman. Minuteman isn't here to be all things to all people. We're not going to be here. And if you're if one of your listeners is a wealthy attorney in Wellesley, or if they're a big biopharmaceutical executive and all that, they're not in our target market, and that's fine. That's not why we're here.
Tom, would you have done anything differently over the last couple of years, looking back?
It's a great question. How much time do you have?
All right, top three. Moments of regret. I should say.
Well, the biggest. It's funny. I was talking to two New Hampshire senators' offices on Friday, and they said, so what are the top 10 issues that you and the market have right now? And so I ran them through, and the first 7 of them were all public policy issues. The last 3 were the things that normally someone who has my job should worry about. Things like, are the right people getting in the right hospitals at the right time for the right care? Do we have the right support for people when they leave the hospital and so they can make sure they have good follow-up? And all the things that I want to be focused on are 8, 9, and 10.
Right. Tom, before we go, I have one final question. And that is that, you have spent so many years working in the insurance market, in the insurance sector. I want to know your thoughts.
Thanks for making me feel old. I really appreciate that.
I want to know your thoughts on making connector plans that are affordable for patients while also not bankrupting insurance providers. How do we get to that sort of magic middle ground? Is there a way to get there currently?
Absolutely. It would take 15 minutes and a pencil and wouldn't cost anybody anything. The first and loudest thing would be to do what the Massachusetts Association of Health Plans has called for. So that's everyone except for Blue Cross is a member of this group. The Mass Association of Health Plans has called for the full suspension of risk adjustment. And then let's sit back and study and come up with one that will work. And that would cover 85% of what we need to do.
You ever think about going to public policy?
Well, inadvertently, I am at this point. I thought I was running an insurance company, but we're kind of a public policy shop on the side.
Well, I think of our current governor who once led, you know, an insurance company through some tumultuous times. All right. Well, thank you so much, Tom. Thank you for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
That's Tom Policelli. He's the CEO of Minuteman Health. Jurors in Boston's federal court heard almost 3 hours of closing arguments today in the extortion trial of four Teamsters accused of threatening the production of the reality TV show Top Chef that was filmed here in Boston in 2014. Testimony ended earlier this week after lawyers for the four union members did not call any witnesses. Prosecutors say the Teamsters showed up at a Top Chef filming in Milton and threatened the cast and crew for not hiring union labor. The Teamsters say they were just exercising their right to protest a non-union production. For the latest in the case, we're joined now from the Moakley Federal Courthouse in Boston by WBUR senior reporter David Boeri. Hi, David.
Hi, Esther.
So, David, today was closing arguments. Can you set the scene for what that atmosphere was like in the courthouse?
Well, the drama has always been in this case what the prosecution is charging and describing and the behavior. They have a 54-second video that was collected by one member of the crew of Top Chef. They show that, but what you see on that video mm-hmm. is four men engage in what can only be called thuggish behavior. Mm-hmm. They engage in what I think we'd all agree is racist comments, vile, homophobic, misogynistic. It's all there. And in addition, the star of that show, Top Chef, testified. Her name is Padma Lachki. Mm-hmm. And she testified.
Oh, yeah, the model. Yeah, former model.
Right, Top Chef. She's the star. You imagine her saying, as her description goes, that the Teamster leaned into the car and said to her, "We're going to bash your pretty little face in."
Ooh.
Also, another Teamster told one of the crew members, "You're lucky the cops are here because I would kill you." So that's always been the dramatic part of this case. And then we had closings today in which the prosecution set out their case. This was not a picket, said Assistant U.S. Attorney Christina Barkley. This was not a picket. This was not mm-hmm. four unemployed guys trying to get jobs for their out-of-work brothers and sisters. This was four men threatening to cause harm to the Top Chef show in order to get jobs. That's extortion. And that was the closing statement.
That was the closing argument from the prosecution side.
Right.
Okay. And what about the defense's argument?
Well, this is what's fascinating, and it gets you into some really complicated but interesting stuff. Is that they, in the words of Hollywood, they decontextualized what the prosecution was saying and said, "Look, in fact, this is a case of people protesting the fact that a non-union company wasn't creating jobs for union members." And this is their right. This is their right. They showed a willingness to talk to the union, or they seemed to show a willingness to talk to the union in the beginning. There were negotiations. They, in fact, walked away. And so we're protesting that. And that's what we are doing.
And did they address at all the video that you're referencing or some of the sort of harsh language?
No, they don't want to address that because it's contemptible, uh-huh. it's outrageous, it's disgusting. But what they're arguing, and here's the key of this case, what they're arguing is this is protest. And it goes back to, by the way, to a Supreme Court ruling that set the tone in this. It's called the Edmunds decision. Mm. And what the Supreme Court found in that ruling was that you cannot be charged with federal crimes of extortion if the underlying act is carried out to enhance a union bargaining position. In other words, you can slash tires, mm-hmm. you can engage in even violent acts, but that's not covered by the Hobbs Act, by federal law. There may be a state statute, but it's not covered by that.
And you say violent acts. I mean, I don't even know. What could you do? I mean, David, you could do all sorts of violence.
Well,
you're saying
the,
it's all
the,
like...
In the case that the Supreme Court ruled on, uh-huh. the defendants in that case were talking about blowing up a transformer. They were... They were electrical workers. They were shooting at transformers. Those were the acts that they were conducting. However, it was the ruling was, look, you cannot interfere with legitimate union interest. Now, union.
So this is a legitimate union labor dispute, they're saying.
Well, with these jobs, so the words that came out of that Supreme Court ruling were, and they didn't define what legitimate was, but they said this is what it is not. You can't go after imposed, unwanted, superfluous, and fictitious services. Hmm. You can't seek those jobs. In other words, jobs that are created just to make you go away, feather-bedding mm-hmm. jobs. What the prosecution continues to say in this case is these Teamsters were looking for jobs that were unwanted by the company, that were unnecessary and superfluous. What the defense attorneys are saying is no, they were seeking replacement jobs. And the replacement would be they would take the jobs of non-union people who would be let go. So that was a replacement. It wouldn't be an additional job. The additional job would constitute extortion. If you were threatening them for additional jobs that aren't wanted, that would be extortion. But if you're looking for replacement jobs, the defense argues, that's not extortion. It's legitimate union activity.
Oh,
it's pretty, it's complicated.
It's so complicated, David. I mean, it doesn't sound like your run-of-the-mill labor dispute, right? I mean, this feels like there's a lot more behind what this case is actually trying to argue.
But when you consider how many union protests by history, in history, and by their nature, tend to involve turmoil, sometimes violence. This is a long history.
Mm-hmm.
The Supreme Court mm-hmm. did not want to go there. They did not want the federal government going there in a case of union, legitimate union activity. They spelled out what the limits were. Now those are going to be tested, by the way, because we have a case under appeal now involving two Teamster members who were indicted and convicted in 2014 in this district. And they were convicted. That's now under appeal. And the members of the appeal court, they've already had their hearings. We're awaiting a decision by that appeals court. But one of the appeals court justices said, look, is this legitimate activity or is it extortion?
Yeah.
That's the question.
All right. So, David, we just have a little bit of time left, say about a minute and a half, and I'd love for you to talk a bit about the political implications here. I mean, are there any? I think of Mayor Marty Walsh, who's been a close ally of unions, a former labor leader himself, running for re-election this year. And unions are a big part of his campaign. Is there sort of any trickiness that he's walking, a sort of fine tightrope?
Well, he has two staffers, two city hall officials,
mm-hmm.
both under the gun now, Kenneth Brissett. Kenneth Brissett called two Boston restaurants in this particular case and warned them that the union, the Teamsters, would be picketing them if they hosted their television show there. That's the basis of a charge against Kenneth Brissett, hasn't gone to trial. And there's another case involving him and Timothy Sullivan, another City Hall official, for involvement with Boston is calling and making the same kind of what one the defense would say pro-union statements, the prosecution would say extortion.
Mm-hmm.
And so they haven't gone to trial yet. We're awaiting this appeal and the outcome from the appeals court. That may well determine what happens with them. And until then, we're awaiting this jury verdict.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously the mayor's going to be paying close attention to all of it.
All right, I bet. Well, thank you so much, David.
You're welcome.
That's WBUR senior reporter David Boeri speaking to us from the Moakley Federal Courthouse in Boston. As you may have heard, over the weekend, an internal memo written by a senior engineer at Google went viral. In the memo, James Damore was critical of Google's efforts to diversify their workforce. One of his most controversial claims was that women are less represented in STEM fields because of biological differences that make them less likely to pursue those careers. On Monday, Google fired Damore, and the story received a lot of attention. Here on Radio Boston, we spoke with Colleen Ammerman. She's the director of Harvard's Gender Initiative. But a column in Tuesday's Boston Globe caught our attention, and so we wanted to have a deeper conversation. Globe tech writer Hiawatha Bray defended Damore and said Google went too far in firing him. And he said that actually gave credibility to the argument that the tech industry is indeed quick to silence conservative viewpoints. Joining us now is Hiawatha Bray, as he regularly does on Thursdays to talk tech. Hi, Hiawatha.
Glad to be here.
So, Hiawatha, you write that in firing Damore, Google was stifling dissent. But I'm curious, is that a fair characterization of what they did? I've actually been speaking with a couple of former Google employees, all on background, nobody wanted to be quoted. And they all told me that they weren't surprised. One former engineer said that she's heard worse things, but this guy was, in her words, not mine, just dumb enough to put it in writing.
Well, there you go. When you work at a place where you're putting your opinions in writing makes you dumb, that raises a real question. Let me be clear now. Google has every right to fire the guy. That's not even on issue here. They have a right to do it. But do we really want to enshrine in standard corporate practice the idea that you fire employees who hold controversial opinions? And to put these opinions in writing is a mark of dumbness rather than a mark of intellectual daring.
So
I think that's a terrible standard.
So I've got to ask you, I understand what you're saying about free speech, but Google is a company. And, we don't really have free speech at work. If I publicly berate WBUR, which I'm not going to do here, I can't expect to keep my job for long.
Well, no. I've tried to make it clear from the very beginning. Google has every right to fire the guy.
Uh-huh.
But I read what he wrote.
Uh-huh.
And what he wrote was a sincere, well-intentioned analysis he thought was wrong with the company's diversity efforts. And by the way, to me, one of the most disgraceful things that has come out of this has been the press coverage. It has been astonishingly inaccurate, repeatedly calling it an anti-diversity screed. The Washington Post on their Snapchat page actually said that he claimed that women were genetically incapable of being engineers. He wrote nothing of the sort.
Mm.
What he said was, women are different from men. Therefore, what we should be looking at is the idea of creating diversity efforts that are rooted in the idea that you treat women differently from men and in terms of how you try to recruit them and train them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you can argue that's a bad idea or not, but it's a sincere suggestion.
Yeah.
And it's hardly an attempt to overturn their anti-diversity, their diversity policies.
So
Hiawatha, the way this has been described has been shocking.
I agree with you that in reading the memo and reading the coverage of the memo, there is this disparity. I'll agree with you there. But I do want to get back to this issue of free speech, which is really kind of at the crux, I think, of what you were trying to argue in your column, is that Google had the right to fire them, but it wasn't the appropriate thing. And I guess I'm just wanting to understand that a little bit better, because on any job that I've ever been at, I kind of know to keep my mouth shut a bit on Twitter, not say too much here or there, because I sort of know that I don't have the freedom to maybe say what I want to say in the same way that I would say in my living room to my husband.
Well, yeah, but for example, you're in a company that's running a diversity policy. It's now forbidden for an employee to say, hey, this policy isn't working. Here's a better way to do it. That's going too far. That's a pretty strange standard to
have. You're talking about Google.
Yeah, right.
Okay.
You can't criticize the company's policies at all without. And besides which, to me, this is part of a larger issue. I think we are, in our society, losing the culture of free speech. This isn't some First Amendment issue, because the First Amendment doesn't apply here.
Mm-hmm.
But the First Amendment isn't the point. The point is that in American society, we're supposed to have a culture of free speech, a culture of open-mindedness where we just let people say what they think. And the internet is actually a classic embodiment of this. I wrote this in a different context in an earlier column. The internet is fundamentally American. You couldn't imagine something like this being invented in Russia or China. They would have built in all kinds of features to keep you from saying stuff.
Mm-hmm.
The people who built the internet were Americans. Their whole attitude was, say whatever you want. Now, we've got the most powerful, or next to Facebook maybe, the most powerful company on the internet saying, at least internally, we don't want you to say things. We want you to shut up.
And does it bother
you, Hiawatha, everything
because,
there is,
does it bother you because it's an information company? I feel like this sort of par for the course in company corporate culture, right? That every company has its own rules that you either abide by or you don't abide by, and you either have your job or you lose your job. And I feel like
that's just right.
What we all know.
That's right. Yes, right. And as I keep saying, Google has the right to do this.
So it bothers you because it's an information company? If this were to be, I don't know, Blue Cross, Blue Shield, I shouldn't list any company, but if it was just any other company.
wouldn't bother me nearly as much, even though I would still think it would be unwise. In the case of Google, it is positively frightening. Google is one of the world's most powerful information sources. This is a company that we now know to be run by people who think that there are certain thoughts you shouldn't have and certain words you shouldn't say. How long before they use that, that is reflected in their search results? There's already some people who think they're doing it on YouTube, deliberately censoring videos that they don't approve of. Now, let me give you an example. This is not Google. This is Facebook. Last year, a bunch of Facebook employees petitioned Mark Zuckerberg and asked, what can we do using the power of Facebook to keep Donald Trump from getting elected? To his credit, Zuckerberg said, that's outrageous. We can't use our platform for that purpose. But there are people who work there who wanted to. And if you have people like that in Google as well, we could be in big, big trouble. If I'm an antitrust guy, I'm looking at this and I'm saying, I'm not letting those guys buy any other information companies ever again. And this is just one more reason to, because this is a company where you sit there wondering, can we trust them to be honest brokers of information when they tell you up front, there's certain things you're not allowed to say up in here.
So
I think that's really creepy.
So Hiawatha, I hear you on that point. You know, you made an argument in the op-ed that you wrote that Google engineers are tasked with writing code that generates an unbiased search result. And therefore, you defend Damore on those grounds. But some folks would make the case that Damore himself is kind of the prime example of a worker who has exhibited an explicit bias.
Well, I don't know how you say that he's exhibited an explicit bias.
Some folks would make that argument, right? I mean, I've heard that from people who used to work at Google.
Well, I suppose in a sense you could say this is a bias. He's biased in opposition to what Google is currently doing. But by that line of reasoning, everybody at Google has some level of bias or ought to.
But he's biased, acknowledging that women have certain biological differences. He did put that out in his memo. And I spoke with a former Google engineer who felt very deeply troubled by that line of reasoning. And she's like, it's not like stuff I haven't heard before. But to put that out there, she felt was a bias. Do you disagree?
But come on, first of all, it's obvious that men and women are biologically different. So,
in terms of anxiety and stress, as he put, that women have less of an ability to deal with stress, you think?
Here's what I'm saying. I have no idea whether what he is specifically saying is true or false. The point is, this guy, by the way, who's a dropout from the systems biology doctoral program at Harvard, actually cited some scientific evidence for what he was saying. I am not qualified to analyze it. My point is, apparently, there is some degree of controversy about this in the scientific community. There
about
are scientists who
women
have
and men
about
being
what
able to
he
do
said.
Things, yeah.
There's actually a posting on, I forget the name of it, there's a website where like four scientists actually went on and said, yeah, there's some evidence for what he's saying. It is not like he made this up out of
nowhere. Couldn't a lot of people make the argument, and they've made it before in history, right, that different races are genetically inferior, intellectually inferior? And I just feel like we would now sort of in commonplace in society deem that those arguments are biases. Is this different? Mm-hmm. Is this not a bias in the same way?
I just think that if there's some evidence for it, and apparently based on what he's writing, there is actually some scientific evidence for it, you got to have the discussion. What are you supposed to do? For example, he actually cites several scientific papers in this.
Folks cited scientific papers, too,
No, here's what I'm getting at. Now, if he's wrong, he's wrong. But to say you can't even say it, I think that's crazy.
Because there's a study, you're saying, a scientific study that suggests
more
that women
one,
are potentially more likely to have greater anxiety, not able to deal with stress. And
this
so because there's a scientific study, therefore it's considered okay, you think? Just so
to talk about it, yes. Talk about it, yes. Absolutely.
So I want to pivot and bring in another voice. On Monday, we spoke with Colleen Ammerman. She's the president of Harvard's Gender Initiative. She had a direct response to Damore's claim that science proves women don't pursue tech because of their biology. She's saying, you know, hold on a minute. We don't really have evidence that suggests this is nature over nurture. And I just want to play a quick cut of her.
Men can actually be ideal workers, can put in a lot of hours at work and sort of feel psychologically and socially rewarded as good parents because they are breadwinners, right? For women, of course, it's diametrically opposed. You know, the mandate to be an ideal worker, to be 100% devoted to your job, comes into direct conflict with the social mandate to be a good parent, be 100% devoted to your family. So women are really facing a kind of impossible choice.
Yeah.
And that's not really a reflection of their ambition or their aptitude or their competence.
So Hiawatha, did Damore shoot himself in the foot by trying to cite science as a rationale for his arguments? I mean, some folks would say that he had some constructive criticism and he could have just left it there.
It's possible. I mean, I think if they hadn't mentioned the biological thing, he might have gotten away with it. I don't know. That was the thing that they specifically singled out. I don't know. But I don't see why you're not allowed to talk about this. I mean, either way, it just strikes me as absurd to argue that it is unfair to bring up stuff when there is some, at least, scientific support for it, and you're not even allowed to raise the question. To me, that isn't the point. Let me make it very clear. I am not defending Damore's conclusions. I do not know enough to do so. What I am saying is, why can't he talk about them? Why is this something that you should be a firing offense at a company like Google, which is full of scientists? This is a company that is packed with scientists. This is the kind of thing they ought to be thinking about. And you're telling them, you can't think about this here. I think that's just a very bad precedent to set.
So, Hiawatha, I've got to ask you a bigger picture question. The tech industry now seems to be at the center of a sort of culture war. I mean, are we entering a point where they're being sucked into arguments that they'd prefer to stay out of? You mentioned Facebook. I mean, Google is not the only tech company here.
Oh, yeah. I wish they would stay out of them personally in terms of trying to manage and govern what we know. Now, they can't completely. I mean, there's a real problem here because there is such a thing as outrageously hateful commentary. People basically hurling death threats and incitements to violence on places like Facebook and the like. And there's no way they cannot try to grapple with that. And how to draw the line is very difficult. I agree with that. But when they start quashing dissent internally, over something that is highly debatable and I think worthy of discussion, it sets a tone and it sets a precedent. And I think it undermines the trust that we can have in these guys as fair, honest brokers of information. And that's really what scares me about it. Again, let me make this very clear. Most companies, if we were talking about General Motors, I wouldn't even be here. I don't care what they do about stuff like that. The reason this matters to me is because it's Google. Or if it had happened at a Facebook
or
a Twitter,
same thing. And so it's an information source for a lot of us.
These guys have a stranglehold on what much of the world knows about what's going on in the world. They could have an immense power to actually start changing what we see, hear, and read based on their internal biases about what they think is legitimate conversation. And I'm looking at it and thinking, I don't want them to have that kind of power. But this is the best argument I've seen in a while for breaking up Google, frankly.
Hiawatha, though, I want to ask you, I mean, Google is based in California. We look here in Boston, our own backyard. It's a tech center, and we're also known as a relatively liberal city. I mean, to some degree, is it not just the fact that a lot of these tech companies are based in places where a lot of their employees would have more progressive politics? And I know that there is an attempt, right, to lure tech companies to other cities. And does this idea of a culture war in tech just mean that companies will essentially move to places based on politics?
I don't know. Well, you know, people are already doing it. You've seen that, haven't you? There's this most dismaying research. That is exactly what is happening in America, not just in terms of tech. It's happening on every level of American society. People are moving out of neighborhoods where they don't find people who share their politics or they don't find people who share their religion. We are becoming this stratified nation, not just in terms of wealth, but in terms of our attitudes and our policies and our viewpoints. And it's scaring the heck out of me personally. I mean, we're just getting to the point where we don't want anything to do with people who are, you know, like even in our same neighborhoods, who don't vote for the same people and don't watch the same TV shows and so on. That's happening nationwide. I don't know how that changes with tech. I mean, the gravity of Silicon Valley, I don't see how you overcome that gravitational pull. It is just this insanely productive place full of extremely smart people. You can't just pick up and move to Texas. I'm sorry, you can't. Well, maybe Austin, but otherwise, you can't just do that. It is this gold mine of highly capable people. But it is also, alas, an echo chamber, which is the title of this document. And that is going to harm them. That is going to make a difference in the long run. Google, I was just reading about how Google and Facebook send people to live in places like India and in Pakistan and places like that and in African countries to learn the culture and start preparing products that will reach out to those markets. I hope they do that now maybe in West Virginia or on my neighborhood,
exchange.
The South. Right, or the south side of Chicago, where I grew up, or something like that. That's something that's badly needed, and not just by these tech companies. Everybody in America should be doing that, because this is getting crazy. We are becoming a country in which you can't say what you think, in which we seem to hate each other. It's not enough to disagree with the other person, the guy who voted for Trump, the guy who voted for Clinton. We're like, we hate them now, and that's insane, and I don't get it.
All right, I'm going to leave it there. Thank you so much, Hiawatha.
Oh, hey, thank you.
That's Hiawatha Bray, tech writer for the Boston Globe.
And listeners, let us know what you think about the growing culture war between these tech titans and conservative ideas. Do you think that this is really just a matter of free speech or corporate bias? We would love to hear from you. So please go to radioboston.org. You can also tweet us at Radio Boston. That's it for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Our show is produced by Kathleen McNerney, Jamie Bologna, and Allison Bruzek, with help from Sean Bowden and Caitlin O'Keefe. We had technical help today from Mike Moschetto. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Asma Khalid. This is Radio Boston.